Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. Now, how's it going out there, all my Bitcoiners all around the world? Thank you for joining me again today here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. Before we get into this great episode with Menny Rosenfeld, first we're going to check in with Swan. Now, I am really, really, really excited to announce that we have launched Bitcoin TV. It's a 24/7 stream of the best Bitcoin content on the web. You can tune in at bitcointv.network or on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/swansignal, where you can also chat about Bitcoin with other viewers as you watch. I've been doing just that, and it is a lot of fun. With this support from many of Bitcoin's best content creators, Bitcoin TV plans to add value to the existing library of Bitcoin education content through production, curation, editing, organization, and presentation. In Q1 next year, we plan to launch Bitcoin TV on over-the-top television services like Pluto TV, Roku, and Samsung. We believe this is the right time for Bitcoin TV to build on the incredible momentum Bitcoin has built over the past few years, as it has become a real player on the world stage. In this time of monetary chaos, Bitcoin is inspiring millions to imagine a brighter future that we can build together, and we hope Bitcoin TV will help unite the world in pursuit of this cause. So check out Bitcoin TV at bitcointv.network and youtube.com/swansignal. Check it out. Let me know what you think. I'd love to hear your feedback. And as always, thank you so much. A deep thank you to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network for including this podcast on their feed. Check out LTBN at LTB Network on Twitter and letstalkbitcoin.com. There are other great Bitcoin shows on there to subscribe to all in one feed. It's really convenient. It's part of Bitcoin Magazine's efforts. I love Bitcoin Magazine. They do fantastic work. I read a lot of what they put out, and they have some amazing podcasts in their own right. I particularly love FedWatch with CK and Ansel Lindner. So check them out. Let's Talk Bitcoin Network. All right, let's get into this one. Menny Rosenfeld is a mathematician, and he's on the board of the Israeli Bitcoin Association. Menny has been around since 2011, so he's a true OG, and he has contributed his thinking to the Bitcoin ecosystem since then. He helped to found the Israeli Bitcoin Association and has worked with the government there to make laws more Bitcoin friendly. In this one, Menny shares stories of his time in early Bitcoin, some of his first contributions, his thoughts on UASF and the block size debate, and his take on the future Bitcoin could bring about in this world. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast, everyone. Again, you know that we are starting to do these things live on the YouTube channel, youtube.com/citizenbitcoin. You can join in there. I'll be monitoring chats. If you've got questions for our guest, Menny Rosenfeld, you can pop them up there and we'll see if we can answer them for you, or even just some comments. We'll pop up some interesting stuff if you have them in the chats. So yeah, let's just jump right into it. Thanks so much for joining me, Menny. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So Menny is a mathematician by trade. And also a Bitcoiner. And let's just start by talking about your background. How did you get into math? And, you know, just start as early as you'd like and give us the backgrounds. Tell us about kind of who you are and how you became into mathematics and pursuing that as a career eventually.
Yeah, okay. So if I had to talk about how I got into math, I would have to go back to a period of my life that I don't remember because I was too young. But so, yeah, so I started being interested in math and having an affinity for math very early on. And yeah, I also started programming early on. I mean, I think when I was 8 years old, 8 years old, I started programming, you know, in GW Basic and Q Basic, Visual Basic. Now, when I do some programming, it's mostly in C#. And yeah, and I think I remember a time in my life when I thought I'd focus more on programming, not so much on math, but over time I got more into math. And probably the, you know, the concrete thing that we can say about it early on is when I started the ninth grade, when I was 14, 15, something like that, I started studies in a university, the Open University of Israel, for a BA degree in mathematics. And I finished it when I was 18, just before I finished school, right? So I studied in high school normally, and in parallel, I studied in Open University, and I finished my degree, I think, a few days before I finished the high school studies. And yeah, and then, as is common in Israel, after that I went to military service in the Israel Defense Forces, where I've been 3 years. And after...
Is that required in Israel?
So yeah, so military service is required. There are some people that get away without doing it, but it's mandatory. Most people do service. Back in my day, it was 3 years. Now it's a bit shorter. So yeah, so there's that. And yeah, and soon after I finished the military service, I studied in the Weizmann Institute of Science for a master's degree in the Faculty of Mathematics and Computer Science. I'm not sure that it, I mean, I see it as a degree in math. I'm not sure it says math and the actual degree. It says it's in the Faculty of Mathematics and Computer Science. So I worked on a thesis with Professor Boaz Nadler in the area of machine learning. So, and specifically semi-supervised learning. So I'll say maybe a few words about that. You know, machine learning is seen to be maybe a part of the field of AI, which focuses on the problem that we have a lot of data and we try to say something intelligent about it. And right off the bat from this description, it's not so clear where statistics end and machine learning begins, and there's a lot of overlap. And so, you know, if one person says he's a statistician and another says he's in machine learning, there will be some similarities, but some differences in the techniques and the approaches. And there are a few, you know, prototypical problems in machine learning. So one of them is classification. So you have data. For each data point, you have the features, which are some information about the data point, and a label which says which class it is. You know, maybe among the most common examples is in computer vision. So for example, if we have a data set with pictures of dogs and pictures of cats, and we want to be able to give a picture to our system and have it say what this is, a cat or a dog. So the label is whether it's a cat or a dog. And the features are either just the raw values of the pixels, or maybe some pre-processing that takes the raw values and does something more intelligent with them. But that's the... No, the general framework. We have features and labels, and we want to deduce the label for new data points where we have only the features. So the way I described it now, it's supervised learning, where every data point also has a label accompanying it. There's also a field of unsupervised learning where there are no labels, and then you do slightly other things, but what I focused on in my thesis was semi-supervised learning, which is probably a bit less heard of, and even though it's very powerful, I haven't seen it grow too much in popularity. But anyway, the idea of semi-supervised learning is that you have a few data points which have labels, and lots of data points which do not have labels. Okay. So in the cat dog example, so in our learning set, in addition to pictures, which says this is a cat, this is a dog, we also have a lot of pictures which don't say anything. We just have this picture and that's it. And the goal of a semi-supervised learning technique is to use also this unlabeled data in a classification. And, you know, at first, it might seem counterintuitive. I mean, how can we do anything with data that isn't even labeled? But if you, you know, if you look at a few examples, you see that it's actually pretty intuitive how to do it. And you know, also, you know, humans, when they learn, they also do something that could be considered semi-supervised learning. So it's really interesting. And I focus in my thesis on techniques that work when the different classes have features that in the Euclidean space span clusters of multiple scales. So probably what I said right now wasn't so clear. I could explain it more, but I don't think that's the main issue here.
A nice mug.
Yeah, it is a nice mug.
Shout out Hodlinat.
Yeah. So after I finished with that, I started working in a company called SimilarWeb. By now, some of you may have heard of it. Back then, it was before anyone had heard of it. And also this company, SimilarWeb, I voted a bit in what they do, but overall, its main ideas are analyzing websites and website traffic and connections between websites. So I joined as the head of research in charge of developing algorithms for all this analysis. Before that, there wasn't in the company anyone who really understood math. They have some programmers, and you know, they did what they could based on algorithms they read about. But I came as someone with a bit more mathematical background to try to improve these algorithms as much as we could. But then, a year and a half later, after I started working there, I heard about Bitcoin. I should probably say how I heard about it. So it was from a website called lesswrong.com, which is a community blog on the topics of rationality and related things. It was a very interesting website. I mean, right now, there's not that much new stuff going on the website itself, but it still has archives of the golden days where there were a lot of very interesting posts there. And this website and this community of Less Wrong is closely associated with Machine Intelligence Research Institute, or MIRI for short, which is a research institute focused on the problem of friendly AI, which, I mean, I could elaborate a bit about that, but yeah, maybe I'll say a few words. So the premise is that eventually there's going to be strong AI, eventually AI that is smarter than humans, and then the premise is that if we humans manage to develop AI which is smarter than us, then AI will be able to develop AI which is even smarter, and then it can rise very quickly, so the intelligence will explode, and eventually we'll have an AI which is extremely powerful, extremely general, right? So first there's a distinction between specific AI, which is AI that does something specific, and artificial general intelligence, which can try to tackle any problem that it faces, just like humans can apply their intelligence to a variety of problems. So if there will ever be artificial general intelligence which is smarter than humans, it can explode in power. And when it does, what it will use all its intelligence for is whatever it was programmed to do, right? So the canonical example is that if This AI was programmed with the goal of maximizing the number of paper clips in the universe. So it will use all its great intelligence to create more and more paper clips and use anything it finds as raw materials to build paper clips. And when it sees a human, it says, oh, okay, let's disassemble this human into atoms and assemble it into paper clips. So that's that's what it would do if its goal function was to maximize paper clips. And the thing is that these goal functions do not change so much, right? Because one would think that once the AI is intelligent enough, it will realize that it's silly to build paper clips, but that's not what's going to happen because the AI was initially programmed to maximize paper clips. Everything it does is towards that goal. Even when the AI rewrites itself, it rewrites itself in order to optimize itself for building paper clips. So this initial goal function that was programmed into it probably isn't going to change. So this is why it's very important that whenever there is a strong AI, it will have a goal function that is compatible with what humans want.
Something so, complex.
So yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's extremely complex. Nobody knows how to encode, how to do that. So, you know, when we talk about it intuitively, we say that we want the AI not to kill humans and to benefit humans, maybe even to obey humans or things like that. But when you try to actually encode it as a program, as a goal function, that the AI can actually work based on, it's not so easy to program that. So, so what Miri does is research ways to encode a goal function which is compatible with what humans want, and so that whenever we have a strong AI, it will not destroy humanity to build paper clips. And of course, one problem with that is that even humans don't always know what they want, and humans are not always rational, and we need to take that into consideration as well. So that's Miri. The people involved with Miri are closely connected to the people involved with LastSong. And at some point in February 2011, Miri started accepting Bitcoin donations, which was, of course, at the time where most people haven't heard about Bitcoin yet. But Miri, being progressive as they are, they were early adopters of that. So when Miri started accepting Bitcoin donations, there was a post about it on LastSong. And I, at the time, did follow LastSong, so I saw this post. And of course, at first, I had no idea what is this Bitcoin thing that they're talking about. But, I looked it up, and the rest is history, as they say. I guess we can talk about some of this history.
So getting an echo again. Maybe try muting yours. Hold on, I can try that, I think. Okay, so yeah, I'm really interested in hearing about how when you discovered Bitcoin at Mealy, I would like to know, first of all, how they ended up using it. Like, if they were getting Bitcoin donations, were they just hodling them? What was the perspective on Bitcoin at that point in time in the organization, and your personal perspective on Bitcoin?
Yeah, so with respect to Miri, I'm not sure. I wasn't that involved. I didn't look up too much what they thought about it or what they did with it, so I cannot answer that question. As for me, so it was interesting for me to discover Bitcoin because it resonated with some things which I had already thought about, which are along two main axes. So one, the concept of cryptocurrencies, I had thought about it before. I think I'm not sure exactly what predicted what, but I think the concept of cryptocurrency, I think it existed before Bitcoin did, and definitely before I heard about it. But I think back then it was mostly a theoretical concept. I mean, there were some ideas before. So, for example, there was David Chaum's DigiCash, I think it was called. I mix up the name sometimes, but there was a currency based on Chaumian binding. So it did use cryptography in all sorts of interesting ways. So maybe the word cryptocurrency had been applied to that, but it's still, of course, it wasn't fully decentralized, and it didn't have all the features that Bitcoin did. But I think I had heard the term cryptocurrency, and I spent some time thinking about how one would implement cryptocurrencies that is really decentralized in some sense. And I had all kinds of ideas, but I didn't spend too much time looking into these ideas. I just thought it would be interesting. And I thought that it's about time that we have money that works better, because the traditional fiat money doesn't really use technology all that much. It's just based on on very ancient concepts. So I thought we need money that is a bit more technological. So I was not very actively, but I was looking for something. And when I heard about Bitcoin, I saw that it does address this thing that which I thought was needed, which is to bring money and finance and banking into the 21st century technology. So does that. Another thing I had been interested in is the concepts of grid computing, and specifically monetization of grid computing, where the premise is that a lot of people have a computer or some sort of computing device that spends most of its time idle, not doing anything. And I thought it's a shame, it's a waste. Why not use all these computational resources for some goal? And now there are, of course, all kinds of grid computing projects. The most well-known is Folding at Home. But there's Boink and all that. But I thought that it would work much better if there was monetization, right? If people could actually get paid for dedicating their machine to computations, then it would be even more effective. And there probably are some projects like that, and maybe some even existed at the time. I think there was something called Paragon, maybe. I looked into some stuff, but not too deeply, and don't remember everything. But anyway, I thought we need more of that, more ways for people to utilize the computing they have at home. And Bitcoin, with its mining, was not exactly that, but it was close enough to be interesting, right? Because right now, anyone with back then it was with GPUs, specifically ATI GPUs, anyone with that could join this computing network, which was interesting, I thought. Both academically and practically, because when I saw it, I thought, oh, that's cool, let's try to mine a bit. And back then I didn't have a GPU which really works for the purpose, because I had an NVIDIA GPU, and not a very strong one at that. So for whatever reason, which I don't completely understand, ATI GPUs were much better for that purpose. So I said, okay, so let's buy some GPUs, let's buy some stuff. And I started doing that. I started mining, and my experience with mining led to all kinds of directions. So for one, I started learning about mining pools. When I just started out, I did some solo mining. It was it was at a time where I, as a person with some GPUs, I could have solo mined, but it wasn't that pleasant. I mean, I remember that I could find maybe a block every day or something like that. And, so I remember that I lay at bed at night, and I was kept up by wondering, did I just find a block right now or not? When I wake up, do I see that I found a block or two or none at all? So it was a lot of uncertainty. It was very, it was taxing emotionally to wonder what's been going on with the mining. So this got me interested in the mining pools. And and that was at about the time when the proportional method for scoring mining pools was the most common. And but people have started to realize that that it's hoppable, that you can do pool hopping with that, and Slush has already implemented a slightly better reward method in his pool, which is a bit more resilient to pool hopping, not completely. So I took it as a challenge to try to come up with a method which will be completely hopping proof, and I did. I called it the geometric method. So other than PPS, which is hopping proof but has its own problems, my geometric method was the first method that was completely hopping proof, which was mathematically provable.
What does hopping proof? What does that mean?
Yeah, so it means that, okay, before we explain what is hopping proof, we need to say what pool hopping is, right? So actually that's, it's a bit complicated to explain. I'm not sure I'm not sure this is the right form to explain the whole thing, but okay, maybe I will. Said we had time. So there's this. So there are mining pools, there are miners at home joining the pool, and in the proportional method, which was popular at the time, the idea is that whenever a block is found by the pool, its reward is distributed evenly between all the miners that participated since the last block that was found. When I say evenly, I mean, of course, proportionally to how much mining or hash rate each of them did. But it's always distributed among the people who mined since the last block. Now, what this causes is that for a miner who wants to decide to mine solo or to mine this pool or mine that pool, if there is a pool where a lot of time has passed since the last block, then it's really not profitable to mine for this pool, because when a block is found, you will need to share his reward with many more people. So so if we look at the reward I expect to get for each unit of mining that I do, if the pool has just found a block, then I get, on average, much more for the mining that I do, much more than if I mine solo, for example. On the other hand, if the pool has had some bad luck and it hasn't found a block in a while, then the expected reward I will get for my mining is much less than if I mine solo or if I mine at some other pool. So the idea is pool hopping is to look at any given time which pool is the most profitable and mine there. And of course, this isn't, there's no free lunch, right? If I do this technique to get more profit for each share that I submit, then it means that miners who just mine normally will get less for each share that they submit.
Okay, that makes sense. And so you developed a method you were getting into and to help disincentivize that behavior, I guess?
It's, I don't think disincentivize is the right word. It's just a pool or a reward method for a pool where it does matter if people do that, right? I mean, the scoring method is different, and it just works out that the expected reward each miner will get will be exactly the correct expectation, which is the same as in solo mining and the same as what he has contributed to the pool. So there was that, and the idea being that if pools adopted this method, then there will no longer be a reason to pool hop, and the people who mine in this pool will just get their normal rewards and not any less than that. Of course, this method has its own disadvantages. I still think, all in all, it is superior. Oh yeah, the flag is fallen. I haven't spent enough time thinking to its place, but yeah, we can still see it. It's okay. It has a few disadvantages, which is why this particular method wasn't adopted so well. Later on, some other methods were developed, some by me, some by others, and some of them did get a bit more adoption. Around that time, my work on the geometric method was very soon after I started being involved in Bitcoin. So if I heard about Bitcoin probably on March 1st, 2011, then I think 3 weeks later, I had already posted about the geometric method. A few more methods and some more work was in the coming month. So around the end of 2011, I published a paper, Analysis of Bitcoin Pool Mining Reward Systems, which gives a detailed discussion about mining pools and the reward methods and some methods that I developed and some methods which other people developed, some methods which I think are really bad, and I try to explain why they're bad. It was an analysis of all of those stuff.
So you were there back in the day contributing to the code base. Do you have any stories you can tell us about some of the early core devs, maybe some of the exciting kind of moments being involved with Bitcoin Dev, and maybe some of the drama that came with it as well?
Yeah, so I'm not sure I can say a lot about that because I didn't really contribute to the actual code. So even with the mining pools, I just did the math and relied on other people to actually implement this. I mean, I will say, one story which is maybe slightly more spicy and maybe even confrontational, that I had some arguments with the Luke Dasher back in the day. Luke Dasher also had his own pool. I'm actually not sure if his pool still works. It was called Eligious. So he had some, methods which he implemented in this pool. First it was proportional, then some other methods. And back then I was very active in trying to get people to use methods other than proportion, right? So I had some arguments with him about that. Not sure there's really that much to get into, but yeah, there was this thing where, he comes up with these methods and I explain why they're wrong, and there were some arguments there. So there was that. Over time we didn't argue so much anymore, so yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. It comes, this is the ethos of Bitcoin development, right? There's a kind of a partnership between mathematicians and other sort of theoretical thinkers, and then, code executors who will execute on those ideas, and then a back and forth between them to arrive at, some good implementation that is quality, which then goes through an extensive review process. It's just a fascinating process to watch, and a lot of interesting minds, very intelligent people, and kind of outside the box thinkers working on developing Bitcoin.
Yeah, so yeah, and it should be mentioned that usually people who come up with some idea are expected to implement it themselves. Right? If someone is, you know, is purely theoretical and just brings out an idea, he's probably not going to get much traction. I mean, most people are not really keen on working to develop something that someone else has come up with. So yeah, so if someone has an idea and is willing to implement it, then, you know, we can talk, but otherwise it will not get so much traction. And that's somewhat of a problem to me because I am more in the theory side. I don't, you know, like I mentioned, I do program, but I'm not a programmer. I'm not, you know, I'm not professional enough in how I develop software that I could meaningfully contribute to the actual code development. So, you know, I've had all kinds of ideas over the years. So, I mean, so for example, everything with the mining pools are not even in the core Bitcoin protocol, but in, you know, the additional services. I had also some ideas which do involve changes in the actual Bitcoin protocol, and maybe those ideas were good, maybe they weren't, but the thing is they didn't gain too much traction because I wasn't really equipped to, you know, to implement them, and nobody else really cared enough. So yeah, and yeah, but you know, I'm comfortable with that. I mean, I do think that whatever needs to happen will happen, and if an idea is good, then eventually someone will want to implement it, even if it's not me. So yeah, so it's a lot of work is needed in order to be treated seriously in this space. Yeah,
it's a very serious project trying to develop money to compete against nation-state fiat currencies and monies. Although I would say fiat is not really money anymore. They've taken the store value aspect out of it, so it can't really be called money anymore. But against fiat currencies in general, it's a big project. It requires a lot of resources, and I think we're getting more and more resources contributing specifically to Bitcoin development from larger companies. And as these companies or large investors sort of take a larger stake in Bitcoin, they're going to be, you know, motivated by number go up and their stake in it to build, you know, fund people who can build and protect and make better and improve the money. That's one of the most amazing things about Bitcoin is that we can actually program it and improve it over time. It's just going to get better and better and better. All those network effects and kind of reinforce each other and developer quality and ability to contribute to the code, to spend time on it is also a network effect that will increase along with that. So I'm wondering, what was your position or experience during the UASF battle for really, I think, sort of the way that Bitcoin governs itself, which was a very important battle in 2017. Of course, it started far before 2017. It kind of came to a head then. Your thoughts and your experience during that time?
To remember what I thought at the time, but I'll start by saying that like you said, the main thing that was being contested there was how Bitcoin should be governed, but you know the technical question that started it was the block size debate, and I think my position on that fluctuated a bit over this, but back then and to a degree still now, I do think blocks should be bigger than they are. And I think even back then it would have been a good idea to increase block size, and even today. So, you know, SegWit gave us a maybe threefold increase in block size, which is not enough, I think. So on one side, I did at that time support that we should increase the block size. On the other hand, I didn't think it means we should, you know, just go and start new projects like Michael and Gavin did. I did strongly believe that we need to reach some sort of consensus or rough consensus, and not that just one person will go rogue and develop his own thing, but try to to reach a joint decision between multiple people who have the understanding to to make the right decisions. So in this sense, I really did not support Bitcoin XT or Bitcoin Unlimited or whatever else happened. So I was in favor of the mainstream Bitcoin development, which was sometimes called Bitcoin Core, which it's not a correct name, right? Because the currency itself is called Bitcoin. Bitcoin Core is just the core software, the transit. But usually in the debate between, for example, Bcash or Bitcoin, so sometimes Bitcoin is called Bitcoin Core. So anyway, I was and still am a strong supporter of Bitcoin and not Bcash or any of that other stuff. But I can't say that it's not that I don't have my reservations at all, because I do, I do think there needs to be a balance in how eager we are to make changes. So there's on one end, you have something like how Ethereum is developed, where whenever the Ethereum Foundation thinks they should make some change, they just do this change and nobody asks any question. Yeah. And on the other spectrum, we have, the most extreme spectrum is saying that there are no changes ever, at least not in the consensus protocol. Of course, the software will be updated, but some people might say that we don't want any consensus changes at all. So that's one extreme. And each position of the spectrum has its advantages and disadvantages. So if we do want a currency that is decentralized and is sound money and can't be taken over and so on, then of course there has to be some resistance to changes. If changes come too easily, it's very open to being taken over. But on the other hand, we don't want to be too rigid. We don't want to calcify, because the current Bitcoin consensus protocol, as great as it is, it's not perfect. It will need to change. And maybe we'll talk a bit more about scalability and secondary solutions, but there was one post that I wrote about the Lightning Network, which is of course great, but even taking the Lightning Network into account, I calculated that in order to support worldwide usage of Bitcoins, the blocks would have to be maybe 100 times the current size. So we will need changes, and so we need to be to some degree open to changes. And I do feel that the current mainstream Bitcoin development approach is more rigid than I would have liked, right? So if we take the spectrum, then Bitcoin development is at some end. I may believe it should be more open to changes, and this it does sometimes make me wonder, will we really be able to make the changes that we need when we need them? So there's that. And I will say one more thing. The way the Bitcoin protocol should work technically is a derivative of what we want Bitcoin to do and what we want to do with Bitcoin. And here we have, different philosophies. So of course, just a second, get some water. Yeah, so if we take the traditional roles of currency, which is store of value, medium of exchange, unit of account. Then, of course, all these roles are important, but there are different opinions on which is more important. And I am a strong believer that the medium of exchange role is, I don't know if the most important, I mean, I don't know if you can really classify it, but compared to a lot of other people, I put a much more focus on the medium of exchange part. Other people put much more focus on the store of value. And the thing is that, you know, how I see Bitcoin and what I thought it would do when I started being interested in it is that it will be able to replace fiat money in banks and so on, that we could have, you know, economic activity without needing government money, without needing banks. So that's what I thought this is all about. But right now, we see that a lot of Bitcoiners are completely happy to keep using government money, to keep using banks. And they say, yeah, so I'll just tell Bitcoin as a store of value and talk to me in 20 years, maybe then. And, you know, of course, there are maybe, you know, advantages to this approach. But to me, it's very weird. I mean, like I said, I think we should use it as a replacement for banks, or at least an alternative to banks. Now it's still not practical to be a completely replacement, right? I mean, it's not practical right now to be completely without banks and so on. But I think that if we want to promote this future vision where Bitcoin does replace banks, then we need to start right now. We need to use it as much as possible and use banks and government money as little as possible. And a lot of Bitcoiners don't see it that way. And this both surprises and disappoints me. And the thing is that the approach that, you know, that puts medium of exchange in the center is often more associated with the Bcash side of things, right? So, I mean, the whole idea of Bcash is that they made the blocks bigger so it could accommodate more transactions. So the thing is that the people who like me support Bitcoin often, you know, don't really see things the same way as I do with regards to, you know, usage of Bitcoin as a payment method. And yeah, this does sometimes concern me. I mean, the thing that that is good is how Lightning is popular, right? So for example, among Bitcoiners, the mainstream approach is that Lightning is good and that this is the solution to scalability, right? So it's not so much that they're saying we shouldn't use Bitcoin, just we use it using Lightning Network, which is fine. And that's my hopes for the future, that Lightning will be able to support or at least help supporting all the usage that we want Bitcoin to have. Like I said, it's not enough. Even with Lightning Network, we will need bigger blocks and so on, maybe some other stuff, but it's definitely a key component. And I do use Lightning Network fairly often, usually for settling the bills within friends, right? So if we order some food, so sometimes one person pays and the other is paying back with Lightning. So it's very convenient for that purpose. And it usually works, except when it doesn't, right? So it still happens that we try to pay, but we can't find any route, or sometimes my channels spontaneously combust, and there are still problems. Mm-hmm. And even when everything works as designed, we still should remember that there are some very important usability differences between on-chain and Lightning, right? In how backups work, in the fact that payments are interactive, in channels being stateful. So there are some differences. It's not like Lightning Network is a magic solution, but it is a very powerful solution, which I think is necessary. So this is something that needs to be kept in mind, right? I mean, some people think that if we have Lightning Network, then that's it. We don't need to worry about scalability at all. And that's not really true. We still need to, you know, take a more holistic approach and improve scalability in all aspects.
It will be interesting to see how Lightning performs during this kind of next run when there's a lot of new folks coming in and fees spike, and there'll be surprises among these new folks that Bitcoin is so expensive to use. They'll probably have heard that it's cheap to use, and that means also that Lightning Network channel creation is expensive, and so that will affect the way, you know, how to get onboarded onto the Lightning Network. So if you think of it as sort of a checking account versus a savings account on the base layer, you know, paying $30 or $40 to open a checking account might seem ridiculous. So maybe you pay $10 if you want to wait a few days to create it, et cetera. So there's these definite usability issues that will be around high fees, based on high fees on the base layer, that will affect the second layers as well. There's already development of third layers, like RGB, which could be built on top of like maybe a single Lightning channel that might help. It's interesting stuff happening, but not necessarily ready for prime time yet.
So like you said, onboarding is a problem because, you know, Lightning is great for everyday payments for someone who is already onboarded, but when you want someone new, then you probably do need at least a transaction to create a channel. And of course, using Lightning is more complicated than on-chain, so it's not so good for newcomers. But you know, over time, the number of potential newcomers will go down. Right, once everybody uses Bitcoin, we don't need to worry about onboarding anymore. It will be just what everyone uses. It's not a problem for the long term so much, but it is a short-term problem, and you know, the short-term affects the long-term. So it is a problem, there is a thing that even its theoretical capability, Lightning is not yet rich. I mean, I'm not completely sure what goes on behind the scenes, but like I said, in practice, there are some problems sometimes when using Lightning. And I guess this is one of the reasons that people still use on-chain. And this is indeed reflected in the fees. So I do think that, like I said, the blocks right now are not big enough to support the kind of usage that Bitcoin could have. I mean, I want Bitcoin to have as much impact as possible. I want many people to use it, and I want each person uses it to gain a lot of benefit from it. And when the block space is limited, then the benefit that humanity as a whole can gain from Bitcoin is limited, because not that many people can use it, and those that do have to pay higher fees, so the benefit they get is lower. So this goes back to the point that I think already the blocks could be bigger if Bitcoin succeeds, and if the growth that has started recently, if it continues, then blocks will need to be even bigger. And when will they, right? I mean, like I said, the development is very, conservative. To my taste, too conservative. Like I said, it's good that it's somewhat conservative, but it's too much for my taste. When will it change, right? If the fees just go higher and higher, and more people want to get into Bitcoin but can't do it effectively, when will it change? I mean, I don't know. I'm not too much, I don't keep track about all the internal development discussions. I don't know how many people seriously are working towards some hard forking change. So it is a cause for concern. I mean, of course, I hope everything will work for the best, but it is something that worries me.
Yeah. What about efficiency improvements on the base layer? You know, compressing signature sizes, et cetera. SegWit was an efficiency improvement on the base layer that gave us effectively, you know, theoretically doubled the block size in effect. In practice, it's more like, you know, 1.4, 1.5 megabyte block sizes. Do you see an opportunity to squeeze out more efficiency gains like that with the hard 1 megabyte limit still set in stone?
Yes. So yeah, I want to maybe offer a small correction regarding SegWit. So SegWit in the context of block space wasn't so much an efficiency improvement. It was more like a trick to trick the nodes into accepting bigger blocks. Right? So if we look at the actual work that is needed to store blocks in the hard drive or to propagate blocks in the network, so SegWit did not reduce that. It did not reduce the actual resources that are needed to propagate transactions. What it did is trick nodes into accepting bigger blocks, which I think is good. Right? Like I said, I think the 1 megabyte block limit was too little, so it's good that we effectively increased it. So and I think it goes about 3 megabyte blocks right now. So, yeah, so it's good that it did, but it wasn't really an efficiency improvement. Yeah, there are other things which are actually efficiency improvements, right, which actually reduce the total data size that is needed, like, you know, aggregated signatures and all that, which is great, but it's not enough. I mean, it's definitely something that it's important to work on, but, you know, it can increase efficiency maybe by a factor of 2 or 3. It's not enough in comparison to how much Bitcoin needs to grow, right? So I mean, I guess the Lightning Network on its own could maybe increase scalability by 1,000-fold, maybe, and maybe some another 100-fold increase is needed through hard forking block size increases over time. So compared to that, you know, the 2 or 3 times fold efficiency increase, it's not, you know, it's not that impactful. So I don't mean to disrespect, right? It's great that we have that, it's great that people are working on it, but it's not even close to be enough.
Yeah, here's an interesting idea on efficiency, and it's not the Bitcoiner way, you know, pure Bitcoiner way by settling every transaction on chain. But Michael Saylor, when he acquired their initial buy for MicroStrategy of 21.5 million Bitcoin, said that they acquired it through 78,388 on-chain transactions, then secured it in cold storage with 18 on-chain transactions, saying that Bitcoin scales just fine as a store of value. So it says that if Bitcoin is treated as a treasury reserve asset, based on our model, 99.98% of all transactions will be off-chain, and asset at risk will be in cold storage 99.92% of the time. So if Bitcoin continues to be used as sort of final settlement or reserve asset or store of value as it is used mostly right now, I think we've sort of settled the debate that Bitcoin should be used for everyday payments on chain at this point, and trying to develop solutions to enable, you know, BTC to be used as we've been talking about. But he's got this idea here, and I think you can acquire a lot of Bitcoin with a lot of transactions so as not to try to move the market too much when you're acquiring a large amount, right? But then once that acquisition is done, then you commit to the base layer.
Well, yeah, so, you know, it depends also on who is using that, because, you know, one of the perspectives that people look at when they, you know, consider the role of Bitcoin is the world is, you know, some poorer countries, right? I mean, it's very nice for us in the first world to talk about, you know, if using it is expensive or not and stuff, value, all that. But, yep, you know, there are, you know, people in Africa, places like that. And we do also want to give them a chance to enjoy this money. And I mean, even if they just use it as store of value, right? I mean, I personally don't think it should be used just as a store of value. But even if that's the only thing they do, if they just, you know, buy some Bitcoins, get to one on-chain transaction and keep that Bitcoin without using that. So if you are poor enough, then even for just this use case, it will be too expensive, right? So if someone in a poor country where, you know, their daily salary is measured in dollars or cents or whatever, so for them, even the one on-chain transaction to, you know, to get Bitcoins and to store them, it's too expensive if, you know, if the system doesn't scale. And right. Even if we try, you know, so it depends on which kind of second and third layer solutions we talk about. But whatever the case, I mean, if we want people to actually enjoy the benefits of Bitcoin, it is expected that whatever method they use, they still keep control of the money, right? So Lightning is great because if you have money in Lightning, you can always unilaterally get it back on chain. So right. When you have Lightning, you are in control of the money. But if you, you know, if you go with some other schemes, then maybe you will not. Yeah. And I do think that, I mean, maybe there are some really creative solutions which change that. But as a matter of principle, if you want actual control of the money, there has to be some on-chain transaction to your name. If the blocks are small enough that poor people cannot expect to even pay the fees for one on-chain transaction, then it's a problem in the context of Bitcoin's, you know, global money that's supposed to help people everywhere. And, you know, and especially, you know, when looking at a vision, which at least some people have or had, that Bitcoin, because it's all technological and digital and no barriers of entry and so on, then it should be, you know, a good solution for poor people, you know, because, you know, bits are cheap, right? And people, well, okay, not everyone has very reliable electricity, but if you have electricity at least, then you should have been able to use Bitcoin. But if the on-chain fees are too high, you can't even do that, even if it's just store value. And I'm not even talking about using it regularly as a medium of exchange. So so that all goes to say that, you know, if we want Bitcoin to have, you know, a real impact on the world, we need to make sure it scales. And it does mean also eventually increasing the block size.
Yeah. Okay. So I would love to hear about how Bitcoin has kind of influenced your worldview, maybe why you are, you know, so, you know, spending time and so much of your thought and energy working on Bitcoin.
Yes. So, the reason I spend much time on Bitcoin is mostly a matter of being in the right place at the right time. I mean, if by some way I wouldn't have heard about Bitcoin until, let's say, 3 years ago, right? 2017 was the time when a lot of people heard about Bitcoin. If that was the time when I first heard of Bitcoin, I don't think I would have been as involved with it as I was. I mean, I would, of course, have been interested. I would have probably invested. I would have thought it was great because it is great. So those things wouldn't have changed. But, you know, basing my whole identity on activity on Bitcoin, it's probably not something that would have happened in this scenario, because you know, because if that was what happened, then I wouldn't have really big opportunity to influence it, right? So I mean by then a lot of people worked on Bitcoin, and you know, I didn't even talk about my activities which were specific to Israel, which back in the day was Bitcoin Exchange Service and later on the Israeli Bitcoin Association. Those are all things that wouldn't have been needing me if I joined later. Yeah. So I probably would have been a user or an advanced user, not so much an activist. But because I learned about it early enough, especially in the context of Israel, right? In Israel, back in 2011, there was almost nothing regarding Bitcoin when I heard about it. I won't say completely nothing there. There were some things that did happen, but as it turned out, I was mostly the one who brought Bitcoin to Israel, and I thought I can make a real, you know, impact this way, right? I mean, I saw Bitcoin, I saw that it was good, I wanted it to succeed in Israel, and I saw that right now there is nothing. So I wanted to do whatever I can to help it get into Israel. And once I started, I just kept at it. And, even now, you know, I have experience, I have some, you know, brand recognition or whatever. So whatever I started now continued to today with having, you know, like a comparative advantage in dedicating my time to Bitcoin as opposed to other things.
Yeah.
So
do you feel like there is some kind of a mission behind this work? I mean, like you said, the mission was to bring Bitcoin to Israel. I get that. That makes perfect sense. And I think you're the founder of the Israeli Bitcoin Association. I know you're on the board.
So Ron Gross and I started it. Each of us had his own role. Yeah, so Ron Gross is also one of the early Bitcoin activists. He got into Bitcoin around the same time I did. He's maybe he's known right now for having led MasterCoin for a while. Of course, he did a lot of other things. So back then, there were a lot of things that Ron and I did together. So the Israeli Bitcoin Association was one of that, which was a continuation of some other work that we've done. Now I don't remember what was the question, but
yeah. It was just about, I guess, like the larger mission for Bitcoin. What I'm trying to get at is like, what do you see as the future of Bitcoin? Do you see it as just remaining as a store of value, alternative to gold, hedge against fiat inflation? Or do you see it as being adopted widely as a global reserve asset and basically become the basis of the basis of the global money?
Yeah, so what I hope will happen is that Bitcoin will be, you know, the mainstream currencies people use for everything, both store of value and medium of exchange, mm-hmm. and that anything else will, I mean, that probably people will use mostly Bitcoin and, you know, second layers on top of Bitcoin. Just like right now, I mean, some people use the term reserve currency. I'm not sure I am very fond of the term, but the currency that everyone uses, that's what I want Bitcoin to be. And there are all sorts of scenarios, but, the ideal scenario is that Bitcoin will be the primary currency, maybe that 90% of all currency usage will be in Bitcoin. There will always be some other currencies for some specific purposes, but Bitcoin will be the main one. Just like right now, US dollars, or maybe each country with its own government money, like those are the main currencies. I think that should be Bitcoin. I definitely don't want it to be just something that people keep as a store of value. I think that's not very interesting. Right? I mean, it has its advantages, but if that's all that comes out of Bitcoin, you know, just people using it as a store of value, I'd be very disappointed. So that's what I hope will happen. What I think will happen, that's a bigger question. I mean, there is a story I like to tell that at one time, I mean, I don't remember which year it was, maybe 2013, something like that. Peter Thiel was quoted saying that he thinks Bitcoin has a 20% chance of succeeding. And my first reaction was being angry, saying, how dare he say it's just 20%? But then I thought about it, and I thought that 20% is a really big chance. I mean, considering the impact that Bitcoin could have if it succeeds, then 20% of that is huge and definitely worth something worth fighting for. So I don't know what is the chance that you know, my ideal vision for Bitcoin will take place, but if it does, it's big enough that it it's something worth fighting for, mm-hmm. even if, you know, the in absolute terms the probability is low. So that's the goal, that people will use Bitcoin everywhere for everything.
Did Bitcoin change the way you understand economics?
I'm not sure. You know, I think the parts which Bitcoin might have changed were parts I didn't really think so much about before. So, you know, I wouldn't say it changed so much as, you know, just, you know, let me be exposed to some new topics which I haven't spent so much time thinking about before. And yes, but I definitely do think that Bitcoin helped improve my understanding of economics in general, of course, specifically with regards to money and what money even is and what makes money money. So these are definitely things which I, you know, became more, more adept in due to the exposure to Bitcoin.
So I'd like to talk about, I have an intro to this podcast where I talk about, I call it the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. And, you know, it's obviously a message full of hope. And one thing that changed for me when I found Bitcoin, besides just teaching me what money really is and about economics, kind of unlearning that Keynesian sort of default thought that we're taught through high school and college. And it was that Bitcoin gave me hope. I realized a couple of things, kind of in retrospect after I discovered Bitcoin. One, that I was kind of resigned to the world the way it was, kind of like the idea that we can't really, you know, as an individual or even like an organic grouping of individuals, change the power structure in any meaningful way. And that's the general trend of, you know, increasing federal power in the United States and increasing control of money, and of course about privacy as well, that we're just going to live in a, you know, a state without any privacy. Of course, all of those problems still exist, but Bitcoin gives me hope on all three of those fronts that we'll have a better future, and that I know holding Bitcoin for my children and for their children, for the long, long term, really gives me a lot of hope that they will have sort of a basis to live a life that they really choose, right? The resources to pursue their dreams and to really kind of hone their craft and become a you know, really world class at their you know, sort of dream vocation. And I hope that for a lot of people. And so I like to think about Bitcoin in the future, 20, 30, 40 years, whatever it is, 100 even, who knows? I feel like it's going to happen sooner than later. We can talk about exponentials. We're talking about exponential tech earlier with AI conversation. So I guess one, do you also kind of see hope in Bitcoin? And then two, let's talk about how fast you think this could happen, considering network effects and exponential, you know, growth of technology.
Yeah, okay, so that's beautiful, but I would have to say that the answer is no. I don't really see it the same way as you, and I'm sure a lot of other people do. I mean, I see, you know, Bitcoin in a way which is a bit more localized. I mean, I think Bitcoin is great, and I think it can really make a difference in the things which it is directly involved with. I don't think of it as, you know, as a harbinger of other things, right? It's, you know, it's a symbol for, you know, freedom of humanity and I don't know, all that. It's not really things I think about. I just think about Bitcoin as a currency, about economics, how Bitcoin is efficient, how Bitcoin can make improvements in, you know, both in the ability of people to be in control of their own finances, in allowing new business models due to efficiency. So it is, of course, something which is, it has a scope which is fairly big, but I don't, you know, let it, you know, spill out to other things. I don't think it's, you know, it's just, like I said, the symbol of freedom for humanity, a symbol of change, all that. I don't really see that they that way. Just wanted to do what it's best at. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's very powerful. It's a tool humanity should have. But, you know, humanity has a lot of other problems. I really don't think Bitcoin will solve all of humanity's problems, not even most of those problems. It solves one very important problem, and that's great. I mean, there are, what's the current number? 8 billion people, maybe. And, you know, and each of them should work on solving some of humanity's problems. So we work on, you know, on Bitcoin, which solves a lot of the economic problems, and even not all of them. I mean, you know, the economy in general is bigger than just money, right? I mean, if we look at it quantitatively, then if you look at all the things in the world that has value, then money is just a small fraction of that value. And in general, you know, money is a very efficient tool to direct economic efforts, but money itself, you know, does not magically improve the economic value, right? So, you know, if we, if we talk about Cheetos, for example, you may have noticed that they have some Cheetos bags in the back, which is kind of an inside joke, but they also like Cheetos. I like talking about Cheetos and give it as an example. So, you know, the fact that we have better money doesn't mean we suddenly can produce more Cheetos, right? You know, the actual economy, whether it starts with the farm where they grow corn and the processing and so on, that, you know, it has its own, you know, laws and resources and so on. So just having better money will not suddenly make everything better. It will allow us to, you know, to do things a bit more efficiently. And, you know, this small bit of efficiency over the entire economy of the world, that's good. That's a huge impact. But it doesn't really does much more than that. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the the alternative view, the more practical view. I tend to attribute maybe more major problems of the world to the debasement and centralized control of the money. I see it as insidious and maybe even beyond our scope of comprehension, even people who sort of have this view, and that we might be surprised when we have a truly sound money standard that can't be co-opted or debased by central authorities, that we might be surprised at how much that fiat money standard was really affecting society. So, you know, that's, I think that that's, I certainly admit that it's, you know, very like optimistic outcome. But I don't think it's a, you know, Pollyannish or naive necessarily. I think that there's a chance that a lot of the problems that we're facing are really begin and are rooted in, you know, the unfairness of basically the programmed unfairness of fiat money, that sort of pyramid and inequality that rises from it, and the inability of people, the time that, you know, fiat money really robs from people, I think is a big problem, and that we'll see giving humans time back is huge, not just like efficiency gains in trade, but really giving humans time back and not stealing from their time, their effort. So that's sort of my take on it. And I appreciate every time that someone sort of brings an alternative view. Let's see. Is there? I mean, we've gone through quite a bit. We're approaching, and I don't want to end it without thinking through if there's anything else I really want to ask you. I guess it would be interesting to hear about Bitcoin in Israel and like just the state of Bitcoin in your country.
Yeah. So there are a few things we can say about that. So, you know, we have a community here in Israel, and, you know, actually, this is also a good time to mention that, like many things, the state of Bitcoin in Israel has also been affected by COVID-19 and everything which depends on it. So, you know, if we had this conversation a year ago, I would talk a lot about the community and the meetups and the activities we do as a group and so on, and the Bitcoin Embassy. And, you know, now with COVID-19, this has changed, right? We don't have as many meetups. If we have meetups, they are mostly online, or maybe we just with small groups. So it's harder to get a sense of the community when there isn't an active in-person scene of community events. But, you know, that said, we do have a strong community. I mean, one of the major, you know, hubs for the Bitcoin community in Israel is our Facebook group, which has been growing steadily. So there's that. No, there are some businesses that accept Bitcoin and not enough, unfortunately. I mean, maybe the success story for a business in Israel that accepts Bitcoin is a computer shop. It's called Plonter. I've been their customer since before I heard about Bitcoin. I think since before Bitcoin existed. And at some point, they started accepting Bitcoin payments. And now every time I want to buy a computer or something computer related, I just buy there, pay with Bitcoin. And I think I'm not the only one. I think they have several customers paying with Bitcoin. But unfortunately, this kind of success story is fairly rare. Most businesses that start accepting Bitcoin end up not having a single customer coming paying with Bitcoin. Right. Until they stop accepting Bitcoin. So
what's the tax situation in Israel when you spend Bitcoin? What's the tax situation?
Okay, so yes, so with tax and regulation in general, so right now Bitcoin is classified as an asset. It's it's in the same categories, just a generic asset, it's not considered a kind of currency or anything like that, which does mean a few things. So first, any profit from selling Bitcoin is subject to capital gains tax, which is about 25%. So that's one thing which is not great, but is understandable. The things which are more problematic is that according to the law, capital gains tax need to be reported individually, right? It's not enough just at the end of the year, file a report, say how much you have profited. You are supposed for every time you sell Bitcoins to issue a specific report. And this includes times which you pay with Bitcoin, right? If you buy something and pay with Bitcoin, it's considered as if you sold Bitcoins. So by the letter of the law, you are supposed to report it individually, which is not really realistic. And the tax authority realizes it's not realistic. That's why they don't enforce it that much. But that's what the law says, which is problematic. And there are a few other taxation related issues, but there are there are some problems, and now this the taxation issue is also have some bad interaction with the anti-money laundering issue, where the thing is, there isn't yet a proper regulation for how to prevent money laundering with Bitcoin. So that's why most, or maybe all banks in Israel, very often refuse to allow any transaction that has Bitcoin involved. Right. So if I have Bitcoins, I want to sell them, get some shekels to my bank account, there's a good chance I will not be able to do it. So this is a problem for people who maybe sold Bitcoins on an exchange. On paper, they have made some profit, but they don't really have shekels in their bank account. Maybe they don't have any fiat currency. I mean, maybe they sold Bitcoins and then bought Bitcoins again. So they just have Bitcoins, but on paper, they have made profit. They need to pay taxes. And the tax authority will only accept tax payment from a bank account in Israel. Yeah. But you can't get money into a bank account in Israel. So it's a mess. And a lot of people are having problems with that. And yeah, that's bad. So that's why we at the Israeli Bitcoin Association do a lot of work trying to change the regulatory situation. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's been very hard. We, even though we've done a lot of work and made a lot of progress on paper, concretely, the situation is still bad. And you know, a lot of the initiatives that we are trying to push forward, they are being delayed, or you know, people are taking the time or whatever. Of course, it didn't help that there's been a period of over a year in Israel that there was no functioning government or parliament, because there was an election in Israel about a year and a half ago, maybe, and nobody got enough votes to be elected, so they canceled everything and did a new round of elections half a year later, and then there still wasn't a winning candidate, so there were a third election a year later, around the time that COVID started being a thing. So throughout all the time, you know, there was some kind of provisional government, but the government wasn't functioning, the parliament wasn't functioning, so it was very hard to promote regulation in this situation. And once they finally did have something semi-functioning, so COVID happened, and then they focus mostly on that. They don't really have much bandwidth to consider Bitcoin regulation. But, you know, in spite of all that, we do what we can. There are some new bills that we've pushed forward that are supposed to change the tax situation. So there's one bill which is a bit more strategic, which will probably take more time to be accepted, but when it does, it will be very nice. And one of them is a bit, you know, bit more tactical, a bit more straightforward, which we hope will be accepted soon, and it will cause some improvement. And yeah, so yeah, so we are in touch with all regulatory bodies, you know, offering our opinion when requested and pushing all kinds of regulation, but there's still a lot more work to do.
Yeah. I did remember one more thing I wanted to get back to, and I sort of had coupled it with that question of you know, like looking at Bitcoin as hopeful. It was about exponential growth of Bitcoin. So do you think this thing could hit an asymptote and just adoption really take off at some point? And if so, you know, approximately like a time frame that you might put on that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the growth should be somewhat exponential. You know, I don't think it will get into hyperbolic growth, because there are factors that, you know, limit things. And so I mean, the scalability issue is a major thing. So for example, let's say even if hypothetically tomorrow humanity as a whole has a change of heart, and suddenly everyone thinks Bitcoin is the best thing ever, they can't all use Bitcoin because the technical framework and the scalability isn't there. So, so this limits the growth. So we need to be in lockstep, right? So there are a bit more users, scalability is better, more users, scalability. So it is sort of exponential, but it's not hyperbolic. Bitcoin can't support hyperbolic growth. So I think we will see a development which is similar to what we have had so far. So, you know, there'll be the big wave, and then it overshoots, and some people are disillusioned, and then it goes back down, and then back up. So we will see more of that. Probably, you know, with smaller fluctuations in relative terms, because people are getting used to it. So it's not such big cycles of, you know, hype and then disillusionment. People will know a bit more what to expect. So I think that, like I said, in relative terms, the fluctuations should be smaller, but there will still be waves and fluctuations and the growth and decline. Yeah, so, and we will have a few more of these cycles until we hopefully get to the point where everyone just uses Bitcoin, so there's not much room for growth anymore.
Right, right. So maybe exponential-ish growth, but with like kind of staggering up and down. The drunkard's walk, if you will.
Yeah,
that makes sense. All right, man. Well, this was a really fun conversation. I really appreciate the opportunity to get to know you and hope someday that we can meet up in person at some conference or whatever. I would love to come to Israel. But I also, do you go to the conference in Riga ever?
I haven't been there, no. I don't have current plans to either, but
Fair enough. Fair enough. So anyway, even if we don't, it's been good to make a, you know, face-to-face connection and speak here. And I will see you out on Twitter. Just keep stacking, everyone.
Cool. Sure. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks to Many for joining me. Find him on Twitter at Many_Rosenfeld. That's MENI_ROSENFELD. And I am at Citizen Bitcoin on Bitcoin Twitter. The podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world. Share this one with your family and friends. The bull is coming. You can feel it. As I'm recording this right now, it's $16,236. We are a stone's throw away from the all-time high, and you know when that all-time high is breached, it is game on. So get your friends and family on board, get them stacking with Swan, we'll take good care of them, no distractions or temptations from altcoins, no high fees, automatic withdrawals to their hardware wallet, and we'll help them understand why that's an important thing and how to get comfortable with holding your own Bitcoin. Dedicated to Bitcoin education, as you all know. So get your friends on board, get your family on board, swanbitcoin.com. Grab yourself a referral link at swanbitcoin.com/enlist and stack 25% of Swan's fees on all of their purchases for 3 years. All right, that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.